The topic is epidemiology, equity, economics, evolution, and enlightenment. So epidemiology at UNC actually began as social epidemiology, so I added some slides to talk about that. Equity, which is another term for social justice, reflects the distribution of power. Economic resources are fundamental to public health, and their distribution depends upon social forces. Evolution, because fundamentally we and our societies are expressions of biology evolving through time as emergent behavior. And finally, enlightenment, because I think a broader and deeper understanding of our nature and our environment may help humanity manage our collective lives better, advancing public health in the present and future. If we don't manage our collective future better, it probably is not going to be all that wonderful. So I think it's really important from a public health perspective to understand more about the human condition. So first I want to talk a little bit about social epidemiology at UNC. In the 1930s, North Carolina was not a terribly healthy place. The 1930s, of course, was the Great Depression, so lots of parts of the country were suffering, North Carolina not alone. But there were many communicable diseases. There were, of course, non-communicable diseases, occupational health problems, and so on. And public health was very rudimentary. It's hard for us now, I think, to realize the extent to which our lives are so well taken care of for most of us, or for many of us, I'll put it that way. Maybe not most of us, certainly for many of us. If we get sick, we can see the doctor. The doctor often has effective treatments. Our lives can be improved. Diseases can be prevented. Immunization is routine. We don't worry every time we get some item of food that it'll harm us in some way. But in the 1930s, infections were not that controllable. That was the era before modern antibiotics. We didn't have that many immunizations available. The doctors didn't know that much. You go to the hospital, your chances of coming out were not so wonderful. So public health was a serious business. And I say that epidemiology was social then because it concerned the public's health. The mission to create a school of public health at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to essentially have a way to train public health officers for North Carolina, was something that people took very seriously. There was a real need for it. And when Milton Rosenau agreed to come to create this school, it was a matter of great excitement. He was a very distinguished and well-recognized expert in public health training, in the public health service, although he was a professor of preventive medicine at Harvard and had created the first school of public health in the United States at Harvard before he came here. So he came in here in 1936 to establish the Division of Public Health. It was a division within the School of Medicine. Those of us who teach epidemiology, I think, will find this description of his last epidemiology lecture thrilling. Probably short of construction blasts, nothing has ever rocked the McNider building, as did the unaccustomed applause from the auditorium the day Rosenau closed the course in epidemiology in December 1945. On, on, and on it thundered and rolled. Overcome at last, Dr. Rosenau turned to the stairs at the front of the room and slowly, quietly started down the long two flights to his office. And still the applause followed him every step of the way, and could be heard by the staff on the ground floor. Only then, with damp eyes, did the class depart. So my lectures have never ended quite that way. But it's a good thing, because unfortunately it was his last. He passed away later that month. But anyway, he was a remarkable person, and he did a terrific job in creating a school here where people were really committed to public health and social justice, although the term wasn't used then, but that's what public health was. The next permanent dean was Edward G. McGovern. He was born in India, the son of missionaries. He graduated from Harvard Medical School and went into the private practice of medicine on the recommendation of Milton Rosenau, who was a professor of his at Harvard. So it was recommended that as preparatory experience there be 3 years in private practice of medicine, preferably in a rural area. And that is what Ed McGavran did before he went on to direct a Kellogg Foundation program for field training program designed as requisite for approved professional status for public health workers, because the public health workers that existed, and there weren't many, didn't have professional training. So the whole public health infrastructure that we now, with all its problems, we depend upon and we have a lot of confidence in, was not here. He got an MPH at Harvard, became a public health officer and health commissioner for St. Louis County, Missouri, became the head of the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, and then in 1947 became the dean and the epidemiology faculty at the University of North Carolina School of Public Health. So, faculty, he was the faculty. He was the chair of the department. He was also the faculty. There were people who came in part-time to teach courses. He had some help. He taught several himself. There's a report he wrote in the 50s describing the problems of the Department of Epidemiology, where he could only give 10% of his time because he was also the dean. And with that, he was teaching, and he lists the courses he's teaching. So it's quite understandable that the department wasn't graduating any students. I think before 1958 or 9, the department graduated 2 master students total during 2 decades, essentially. So he was a remarkable man, also very committed to public health, the practice of public health, and the training of people to be active in public health. So finally, Ed McGavran got resources to recruit a full-time faculty to the Department of Epidemiology, and then John Castle had become a faculty member in the Department of Epidemiology. John Castle was in South Africa, came to UNC and did a master's of public health, came back to serve on the faculty, and he brought or recommended Sidney Clark, who was his mentor in South Africa, to come and be the chair of the Department of Epidemiology to build up the department. Sidney Clark was born in Johannesburg, South Africa, graduated from Witwatersrand University Medical School. He led a health center called in a town called Falela in rural Natal province in South Africa with his wife Emily Clark, who was also a physician. This was probably the first manifestation, at least in the Western world, of community-oriented primary care, where the health center took the responsibility for the health of the people in the community. And it was I don't know how many of you are familiar with Jack Geiger's work at Tufts Medical Center, and then in Mountain Bayou, Mississippi, Jack Geiger and John Hatch created the first community public health center in a rural county. So that came from Jack Geiger, had been a visitor also at Falela, learning from Sidney Clark. So anyway, he became as the first full-time chair of the UNC Department of Epidemiology. And then he was succeeded by John Castle, who was already on the faculty. And John was also born in Johannesburg and also got his MD from Witwatersrand University. He joined the staff at the Durban, Institute of Family and Community Health, the IFCH in Durban, which now was creating a network of these health centers. He became the medical officer in charge of the Falela Center in 1953, and then he came to UNC for an MPH, tried to go back to South Africa, but by then the government in South Africa had changed, had become, the apartheid government was in force, and the activities of these community health centers were not looked upon with favor, so it was better for him not to go back. So he became the first permanent chair of the Department of Epidemiology. He recruited, Sidney Clark recruited several faculty before John became chair. One was Ralph Patrick, who had a PhD in anthropology from Harvard University, and was at the time an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Washington University in St. Louis. He was appointed an associate professor in 1958. Notice anthropology. Where's the epidemiology? Al Tiroler, who was born in Brooklyn, 1924, was in the U.S. Air Force, worked as a consultant and director of research at Occupational Health Services in Asheville, North Carolina, and then a research director for a foundation. No formal training in epidemiology. He was brought in as an associate professor in 1960. And Dave Jenkins, with a 1960 PhD in psychology at UNC, joined the department in 1960. So there was a nucleus of social epidemiology people who were actually not trained in epidemiology, but they were trained in social sciences. And what John Castle did when he took over the department was to create this epidemiology department where there was a variety of people who could bring different aspects of the social sciences. And he did this on the basis of what had been recommended to him. And then Bert Kaplan. Bert Kaplan started out with a degree in business administration and personnel administration, went through the U.S. Air Force also, studied social anthropology at the University of Edinburgh. Bert was my advisor, my mentor. He was a research assistant to John Castle in the 50s, had fellowships and preceptorships, got a PhD in sociology, but before he got his PhD, he was attending epidemiology seminars by John Castle for years. There were several people who did. I think David Jenkins may have done that too. So did Steve Zizansky. I didn't get a slide for him yet. Bert became an instructor and then later an assistant professor in the Department of Mental Health in the School of Public Health here. We no longer have that department. It had some issues apparently. But he did that, and then he went up to Cornell for a fellowship and got a call from John Castle asking him to come back and be on the faculty in the Department of Epidemiology, and a call from the chancellor asking him to do that as well. So he was pretty sought after. He created the first NIH training program in it was called Psychosocial Factors in Mental Health and Disease. That was the original psychosocial epidemiology program in the Department of Epidemiology, and it's the one that actually I was recruited into for my PhD. Then we have Sherman James. So Sherman, his PhD, he was also in the Air Force. His PhD in Washington University was in social psychology. So again, no epidemiology. He became an assistant professor in 1973, having been recruited by Ralph Patrick and John Castle. Bill Jenkins, I don't know how many of you have had the pleasure yet of meeting Bill Jenkins. Bill Jenkins interviewed Sherman a few years ago, and I cut out a 6-minute clip from the interview to play for you because it's so terrific.
So you got the call from Ralph Patrick, and what was your reaction to, you know, a field that you hadn't thought about, but, you know, they were...
Epidemiology or what?
This is a faculty recruitment, right?
What is that? If I had heard of epidemiology, you know, it would have been accidental or something, I had nothing about it. But he said, well, come around and let's have a conversation. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, it's around Christmas time of 72, and I felt a needed break, and if they wanted to pay for me to come to Chapel Hill, which is only 3 hours from where I grew up, mm-hmm. who am I to say no? Mm-hmm. You know, but I really wasn't very interested. And I knew nothing about it. You know, and I said, well, you know, this will be practice, you know, on the job market. And so I came really pretty relaxed. I didn't care much whether I impressed anybody or not. Mm-hmm. And the first interviews weren't really all that inspiring. Mm-hmm. Mildly. What do I talk about with parasitologists, right? I know absolutely nothing about that, or virology. But over the course of the day, the conversations got more interesting. You know, that David Kleinbaum, vice president.
Oh, yeah.
Brooklyn Dodgers fans.
Yeah.
He's from Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Right. Interesting guy, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe he might be fun to kind of, you know, I'm glad I met him.
Yeah.
Right. I see him again, and I'm glad I met him. But more to the point, so at the end of the day, I suspect that Vic has heard this, maybe you should have heard as well, Bill. At the end of that very first day, I had an interview with John Castle. And I walk into his office maybe at 4 o'clock, and I'm very nervous. Nope, this is not going to be for me. I'm just going to try to get through this and get through tomorrow, and I'm out of here to go see my folks. Sit down with John Castle. He's sitting behind his desk. Filling with his pipe. And he just starts talking. And about everything else, and more specifically about social equity. And why someone like me might actually be, should be interested in being a black southerner and starts talking about black, white. At the time, we weren't saying all disparities, but he was talking about.
Minority
health, or the challenges. And obviously, I didn't know this until much later, but drawing on his own experience in South Africa, as a way of underscoring just how important, an appreciation for social, economic, and political, and cultural factors are, some of which could be, health promoting, and oftentimes they're not. Oftentimes they are health compromising, and so that if I were interested, in being involved in a field that really brought together science and interest in social justice, this was the field. And so because I came of age, as you, Bill, during the civil rights era, you're always looking for ways to make a contribution, but to do so in a way that fits who we are as people, right? So so I began to think that, hey, this might be a way to make a contribution to things I care about in terms of social justice issues, in terms of African Americans, circumstances in America, through academics, through teaching, through research. Now, this is something that kind of evolved over time. It's not like I made all of these connections at once in the conversation, but the seed was planted by his exposition about what everything else was about. This was like, so now I began to think, well, gosh, maybe this is really what I've been looking for all my life. What medicine, science, social science, it's like, in a sense, the ministry, healing, bringing people together, I said, this is so much broader and richer in terms of possibilities than academic psychology, or ministry, or medicine. And so, I didn't think that there were, by this time, I'm interested, I want to know more. So, for the remainder of the second day, I'm sitting on the edge of my seat trying to learn as much as possibly can about this thing called epidemiology. I'm no longer, sitting back and being nonchalant. And so by the end of that second day, my hand is in a different place. Well, this is really very interesting. But I didn't think that they were going to offer me a job. I said, well, surely let's have somebody else in mind. And 3 weeks later, I got a call from Ralph Patrick. They were like, offer me a job. I said, well, so I thought about it. Talked a lot with my professors, talked about my wife. And we realized that there were perhaps a lot of reasons for coming to North Carolina, coming to Chapel. Howard Lee was mayor of Chapel at the time. That was interesting and different and new. And so, we could be closer to our parents, our respective parents. Our kids, our boys, we had two boys at the time, people were close. They could be closer to their grandparents. And it was this exciting field, that I would be challenged by, could learn and grow, learn new things. Why not give it a shot? If it doesn't work out, I can be the ace to retreat back to something I do know about.
I really enjoyed that. When we finished that interview, I thought, that's probably my major accomplishment. So that's epidemiology at UN. There's more, obviously, and it's on a terrific trajectory. But let me turn now to equity. So what is health equity and social justice? I'm going to go quickly through these because, of course, there's not much time left, and I wanted to give you a broad picture rather than focus in on things. But there's a diversity. I mean, people are diverse, and diversity leads to different judgments. I don't think there is a definition of equity, or there are many definitions of equity, and people will debate about which theirs are. There are contrasting philosophies, such as that people deserve what they can get, and there's the philosophy that everyone should have what he needs or they need. The former philosophy has strategic advantages because it requires less cooperation and less enforcement. If it's okay for people to have what they can get, that's great, in the sense that you don't have to try to change things. The latter philosophy, though, may produce more harmony, so we may have problems of disharmony. Judgments about equity reflect power, and the impact of the judgments depends upon power. So you can make all the judgments you like, but if you don't have the power, what difference will it make? Influencing actions requires more power than influencing words. We try to influence what statements are made, and you can find, I mean, there are treaties and the Declaration of Human Rights and all these wonderful things. You read these documents, how could there be any health problems in the United States? But the words are one thing, the actions another. Equity requires modest differentials in power and resources. I think there will be differentials, but they could be modest. They are not modest now. So that's a problem. We did a webcast on health equity, political power, policy, and health equity last June. It's available online. Had a very knowledgeable panel, and we had Professor Tom Ross, President Tom Ross, as the moderator, which was a thrill for me. Coming February 24th, the Minority Health Conference, the 38th annual Minority Health Conference by the Minority Student Caucus, will be on systems of power, recalling our past, restructuring our future. So put that on your calendar. What has epidemiology taught us about health equity? The immediate essentials for health, we know, air, water, food, clothing, shelter, protection against living material that may harm us, like from the insects, the microorganisms, to the insects, to the animals and the other and people. And broader essentials are some degree of personal autonomy, access to resources and services, knowledge and information. So in my first semester as an epidemiology student, I was taking a seminar class from BERT, and this was one of the readings, Social Class Susceptibility and Sickness, by Leonard Syme and Lisa Berkman. Leonard Syme has a very good history of the development of social epidemiology, by the way. In it, they say, social class gradients of mortality and life expectancy have been observed for centuries. And this was in 1976 that they published this. And we have continued to catalog the differentials in health, the inequities in health that are related to socioeconomic status. The preponderance of health problems occur to people with limited resources. Not every health problem, there are some, but even problems that are not initially focused on lower economic people, like, for example, cardiovascular disease, the United States was at one time a disease more for the middle class than for the poor, than for the working class. But over time, it migrated to the working class, as did lung cancer. Resources are linked to power. Power begets resources, and resources beget power. So that brings us to economics. In the 21st century, the United States, continuing from the 20th century, income and especially wealth are key determinants of individuals' and groups' power and access to resources. Income and wealth especially are very unequally distributed, and they bring associated differences in healthcare, support, knowledge, choices, opportunities, influence, control, decision-making, autonomy, essentially almost every aspect of life. And disparities tend to grow. They tend to persist and they tend to grow because if you have more, you can accumulate more readily. If you have more, you can invest more in your family, your friends, in your associates, and the organizations that you are interested in. And you can disproportionately influence the rules of the game, which improves your prospects and the prospects of people you support. These influences are not absolute, because there are conflicts and contradictions, and there are various sources of power that compete with economic power. You know, there were a number of millionaires in Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. Millionaires arose, and some of them haven't done so well, despite their money, because there are other sources of power. Russia is not a great democracy, and in a democracy, money can buy power. But when it's not a democracy, it can sometimes, but there are other sources of power that may not be easily purchased. In the U.S., money has considerable access to power. economics is a fundamental determinant of the way life works. And I think epidemiologists would do well to learn more about how economics works. Every process, every agent in any living system, and every organization needs resources. That leads to competition for resources, but also to cooperation, because if you're cooperating, you can compete more effectively. This is inherent in society. It's inherent in biology. We can say, oh, capitalism is terrible, there's too much competition, whatever. But competition is inherent. You can't avoid competition, and you can get rid of capitalism, but you still have competition. Resources are needed for current consumption and for investment to increase future capabilities and productivity. Resources can be obtained in various ways. Profit-making enterprises have the most direct access to resources, especially in democracies, because consumers willingly provide the revenue for corporations or for companies. Government programs need to get agreement on revenue. There are stakeholders who get to say, well, you can't have this money or you can't. And that means political support and compliant taxpayers. Government and especially business have found ways to entice people to give over money. So we have the Powerball and the various other lotteries. People willingly give their money to programs. Interesting phenomenon. They wouldn't pay a tax, but they're willing to buy lottery tickets. So another fundamental determinant of what goes on in society is evolution. I assume that you all believe in evolution. It's interesting that I can put it that way, because there are people who don't believe in evolution. It's like saying there are people who don't believe in gravity. It's a very interesting phenomenon in the United States, in a country with the vaunted education system that we have and the material well-being, that we have a lot of people who don't believe in gravity. Well, okay, I don't believe in evolution. or climate change. Isn't that kind of remarkable? So we'll get to that. So evolution, I never studied biology in college, and what I've learned from evolution I've kind of picked up along the way. But basically, this, to me, the basic principle of evolution is that what exists has, for the most part, survived from yesterday. So whatever we see, for the most part, it was here yesterday and the day before and the day before. Strategy, this is not true only for biological organisms. Strategies, reason, values, all of that stand or fall based on whether they survive over extended periods, except that some things can arise anew. Things that are elaborate and complex tend not to arise anew because it's more complex for something like, it takes a lot more for something like that to come into existence. So if you have an organization and it's a complex organization, it will usually take time to develop and it can disappear. But it doesn't pop up again so readily. Adaptability, reproduction, inheritance, diversity, growth are key in evolution. Environments change. Agents compete. You need redundancy and a portfolio to cover all the contingencies. You can have a great species, but if it doesn't have enough diversity, if it doesn't have a portfolio of capabilities and a way to pass them on, the environment can change and that species can be gone. And most species do leave, and we don't know how long ours will be around. Cooperation can increase success, but cooperation requires trust, which also opens the door to cheating. So you need sanctions. That's the idea of fairness and justice, is to try to have some ethic or ethos that will lead people to be trustworthy so we can have cooperation. And all this is extremely complex. We're always oversimplifying. Emergence, which is another E word, you know, I'm looking for words that begin with E. Emergence is the term that I like to use to describe what our society, how our society exists. You have billions of people, each person with billions and billions and billions of neurons, as well as other cells, and there are a whole lot of microorganisms in each of us too, more than there are human cells. We are communities. And this incredibly complex mix of individual agents, each one having some latitude and a lot of influence from elsewhere, is interacting. So you have hundreds of billions, or you have tens of billions of neurons, you have trillions of connections among them. And what emerges from these interactions is what we experience in terms of what we see, what we think, what we do, and what happens in a society in an aggregate. So it's emergent. It's an emergent phenomenon, much too complex to explain in any simple fashion. There are patterns, and we can derive benefit from understanding the patterns and detecting them. But the reality is so much more complex than anything that we can actually work out in a formula or equations or models. So the models are getting pretty darn good. So let me talk about enlightenment a little bit. Business as usual is probably not going to work long term. The environment is being degraded. If you read Science Magazine, or even if you just look at it, which is what I do, there are steady stream of articles about species loss and climate change and depletion of this and pollution of that. And even if we don't feel it directly, it's happening. And increasingly, there are parts of the world where they are feeling it directly. So the environment dictates the need for a more enlightened approach to human living. We cannot afford to waste so much wealth through things like wasteful and harmful consumption. We have this wonderful economic system. It's just phenomenal what it provides to us. I enjoy the privileges more than most of you probably, because I've now had years to accumulate and so on. But this economic system seems to require that we push people to consume things they don't need to consume, which may be fine short-term in some locations, but now translate this to the 7 billion people in the world who at some point are going to need to be brought in on it. It doesn't compute. It's not going to work. We have excessive competition, poor judgment and mismanagement, corruption, poor governance, and military excesses. This isn't going to work. If you had an organization that had these problems, you would say, I'm not going to invest in this organization. What can epidemiology contribute? Epidemiology is transdisciplinary. It integrates across all fields. It's purposeful, goal-directed, practically oriented, holistic, and it uses a system thinking approach. If not epidemiology, who is going to be able to address these questions in a comprehensive fashion? There isn't any other discipline that is willing to be as broad as epidemiology. We are not fundamentally about medicine. We are not fundamentally about genetics. We are not fundamentally about logistic regression, whatever it is. These are all modalities, but epidemiology has the purpose of improving human existence through the understanding of what happens in populations. So I think epidemiology should devote more attention to studying how the nervous system works, thinking, non-cognitive processes such as attention, biological influences. Our brains are biological organs, and they are influenced by various factors in the environment, in the body, and psychologically. There are behavioral environmental influences and physical environmental influences. There's work on decision making. I've got loads of examples in that place, but there you could find obviously in Google. So I think epidemiology should be studying what influences consciousness. Breadth of awareness. People who just focus very narrowly think only short term rather than the implications. What, some people do, some people don't. Why? Epidemiology says if there are differences, you can look at the characteristics of the people who have this condition or don't have the condition, and you can see what's related to it. We could do that. Generosity. Why are some people with a lot of wealth generous in contributing to society, and others simply use their wealth to make more wealth? Could that be a mental disorder? Is that something epidemiology could study? So I'm just going to throw some examples here to kind of whet your appetite. We have an election coming up. So these people did a study, this is back in 2009, where they showed university students photos of candidates from a recent election in Europe. And they asked them whom they would vote for. And over 70% chose the candidate who actually won the election. This is before they knew the election. So then they took the same photos and they asked children to choose a captain for an imaginary boat trip. And the same candidates won. So is this is our democracy, our vaunted the will of the people? This is self. Are people really capable of self-government? So it turns out that you can influence people's ability to perform on detail-oriented tasks and other tasks by expressing the questions in red or in blue. But the red changes the way people approach things. Red induces an avoidance versus an approach, and blue enhances performance on a creative task. How could this be? Aren't we rational creatures? How could we be influenced by color? So this was an interesting study where they looked at pairs of countries, whether people from that country would inflict terrorism on another country. And what they found was that the survey results from the country would give, like, how do people in this country feel about that country, that would actually relate to the probability of terrorism being committed by people from this country on that country, suggesting that maybe there's a continuum in terrorist behavior, that it's the extreme end of a continuum of how people like each other or don't like each other. Oxytocin, which is a hormone in the body, turns out it affects whether people will be more competitive or more cooperative, whether they will be. This one study talked about what they called in-group love and out-group aggression. So by giving oxytocin, they made people more willing to help each other and be aggressive or take things out on the other group. So, and then these were a couple of examples of studies showing how emotions can be contagious. I'll just mention the second one. So Facebook conducted an experiment where they manipulated the news feeds for over 600,000 users, either removing all of the positive posts or all of the negative posts to see how it affected the moods of the Facebook users. You may have been one. Anybody here use Facebook? So, interesting, A, that they would do this. I don't know if there was an informed consent attached to it. Probably wasn't. It wasn't federally funded. B, are we aware that this is being done? C, did we realize it would affect us? Not surprising that it would. But of course, this was the data scientist, but stuff like this is going on all the time. So, last thing I want to talk about is TM, Transcendental Meditation. I learned it in 1972 when I was a master's student in health education. I think it has terrific public health potential, as some of you have heard from me. I'm just throwing up a couple of studies. There have been hundreds of studies about TM. I'm still waiting for the kinds of epidemiologic studies that I thought I might do when I applied to the Department of Epidemiology, but never got around to doing. I'm not so much of a manager after all. So this was a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials of the effects of transcendental meditation on trait anxiety. They located about 400 studies. There were 600 studies, 16 with over 1,000 participants studied trait and state anxiety. The standardized difference in means is the effect measure that they used. So that's the difference in means divided by the standard deviation, and it was showing a goodly impact for people in the TM group compared with the alternative treatment, the controls, which they had a wait list or attention controls. Very hard to come up with the best control group for TM. It's not an easy thing to study in this most rigorous way that we would like. The populations with elevated initial anxiety levels had the biggest effect. And TM is being used with people with chronic anxiety or veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, prison mates. It's been used in schools. I wanted to show you a video, but I don't have time. And this was interesting to me also, because I think better management and better government statesmanship are critical for us to improve our public health in a very broad sense. So this was a study of total quality management and the TM program in Sweden. There was a Swedish management team where all of them were practitioners of TM. And the article looked, it did a case study analysis, essentially, that suggests that increased maturity permits expression of more effective cognitive, affective, and team total quality management behaviors, as indicated by improved team functioning and planning. and that the practice of TM promoted the psychological maturation. So this is not the kind of study that epidemiologists usually look at, but what I think is it gives us a vision of what may be possible, that if we want a better outcome from an emergent phenomenon, the agents need to be better. As an example, if you took away literacy, if you expose everybody to lead, IQ goes down, what would happen to those populations? What does happen to those populations? Because, of course, there are populations that are exposed to lead. Their IQ goes down, their non-cognitive effectiveness goes down. The results are worse. And so if you could make things better, if you could make people better, wouldn't you get a better result? Isn't that why we try to recruit the best students to the department? Because we know that the best students will do better and make a better department. So I've got a lot of references in my virtual library on social justice and equality. Come visit. And thank you very much for letting me give this presentation.